Hey guys, we have a very special guest today. Eric Finman is joining us on Sewing Discourse. We were recently connected by Ali Alexander. Some of you know him very well. And Eric was gracious enough to say, yeah, let's have a chat. He liked our channel, and here we are.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
So I recently saw you were on a podcast that we were on. So we're both Autistic Mercury Tech Wars alums.
I guess so. I don't know. For better or for worse there.
Yeah, you, me, and John McAfee. McAfee.
That's good company.
It is good company. So I'm familiar with that podcast because Lev introduced me to some, it's like this extremely online community. They're kind of right wing and left wing. They're on the fringe. They talk about literature and politics a lot. And so Lev is the chair of the Art and Tech Committee of the National Arts Club in Manhattan.
Interesting.
So Lev has wanted to elevate part of this extremely online community, and he's introduced some of their work to the National Arts Club. And it's a way of celebrating free speech. It's a way of putting extra focus on big tech censorship as well. Mm-hmm. So that's what inspired Lev and I to start this show and to start even partnering with Ali Alexander, because you know a lot of the work he does on culture, they focus on people who have been deplatformed, right? Mm-hmm. So the Autistic Mercury, I think they like to push some buttons. I know some of my friends listened to that show and they were like, what the heck were those guys talking about? It's like a lot of times they have this uncomfortable humor, mm-hmm. and then they just start laughing due to the discomfort of their, you know, their, I see them as, Lev, how would you describe the Autistic Mercury?
I describe them as people who are living up to the expectations of what would be considered intellectuals today. We have people online who are into, you know, all these old esoteric texts, who are interested in reviving a lot of the same spirit that I saw in the Renaissance, while people who are on the quote-unquote intellectual elite class, they seem to be more concerned about transgender bathrooms.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Yeah, I agree. It's interesting to see on the internet, yeah, just how many people are looking at the old literature stuff. Like, there's all these old lit accounts on the great books, I think, whatever is it. Yeah, I find it absolutely fascinating. And I think just in even cultural issues today, these kind of old books, actually, the type of thinking and logical thinking applies to even things like transgender bathrooms and all that. That's what's funny. They should look at them. They should look at the old books to help you think of the logic of these things that are happening today as well. So it's a waste if you don't look at these old great books, right? So I think that's really important.
Well, they were giving you a hard time about blockchain, right? They're like a satire. They're like satire, a lot of it. And your Twitter says you're a satire of new money. What is that?
Yeah. So I think I did these. So I'm, you know, really into technology. I built a lot of great technologies. We launched a satellite last year. We built this real-life Dr. Octopus robotic Boss Dynamics style suit, which was really cool. One of the things I learned was, you know, have a little showmanship. And when you have a little showmanship, that can bring attention to great technologies. Because I grew up seeing all these great tech guys just have their projects go to shit because they didn't, you know, have any showmanship to bring to their tech, right? So I kind of did these things where I was the satire of it, which was I would just look like probably the most obnoxious douchebag rich Bitcoin millionaire guy you could ever imagine.
People fill in your head with that.
Yeah, no, and then so, you know, someone said you're like some, you know, Eric Finman, somewhere between Elon Musk and the Wolf of Wall Street. And people called me the Wolf of Bitcoin for a while. But yeah, so I did these kind of super, they were fun. I won't lie, they were fun to kind of satirize. But yeah, I guess I was satirizing, yeah, just kind of new rich Bitcoin millionaire. And that was a lot of fun. But yeah, it's been fun. So I guess we matched up there with that podcast with we both do satire a little bit.
Is it kind of like Jeff Bezos in his Mech Warrior suit? Is it that similar kind of vibe?
Similar, very similar, very similar. But ours is better.
I don't get an obnoxious vibe from you. I followed you. I've followed you for a while. And what is obnoxious these days? I think there is a lot of envy and jealousy in our culture. And someone sees a young, intelligent, successful person. That's it, right? The fact that you invested in Bitcoin in 2011.
Wow. Yeah, I did.
Wow.
No, that was crazy. Yeah. I was at this protest. I was at this protest in 2011, and then we were like running from the fucking SWAT team, and then some guy had a. Can I cuss on this podcast? Is that chill? Like,
yeah, sure.
Cool. So I don't know. And then we were like running from like SWAT who was tear gassing us at this protest, and then some guy had like a Bitcoin shirt on. And I was like, and it was kind of a thing at the event. You would wear a shirt and you would talk about what shirt you were wearing. And then the guy told us about Bitcoin, and then the rest is history. I just bought it with my brother, and that's how I did it.
So you learned about it in an adrenalized moment. So there was like, what was the protest? Was that an Occupy Wall Street or?
It was a blend of a lot of things. I think it started out, it was more like a Footloose type protest. Someone got arrested for dancing, but it kind of morphed into a lot of different things. So someone was a memorial for dancing with their headphones on. They shoved them to the ground and beat them up. And then it was kind of a bunch of communities kind of came to protest that. So it was more, Kevin Bacon was unfortunately not there, although we should have been. But that's how I found about it. It was crazy.
I actually watched Oscar movies at Kevin Bacon's once. I watched his There Will Be Blood screener.
You met Kevin Bacon?
Yeah. His daughter went to my high school, and I'll always remember, we haven't talked in years, but in high school, you know, everyone, it's a different, it's a different kind of a hive. And, yeah. I'll always remember watching There Will Be Blood screener on Kevin Bacon's
television. Wow.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Living the dream, my friend.
Well, those are the things that, you know, it's like, it's no big deal. I mean, I think I floated out there now because we are working on our shilling, and we are working on our puffery for the show. So we've been trying to tastefully scale that kind of content in as much of a non-tacky way as possible. And so I thought, on the subject you're talking about, Bitcoin, and it's like Kevin Bacon is a goddamn expression, right? Everyone knows 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Mm-hmm. Niall Ferguson these days says everything is 3 degrees of Kevin Bacon. So, you have that MetalPay.com.
MetalPay, yes.
MetalPay.
So, I invest in this company called MetalPay. And basically, it's just a super dead-ass simple way to get into crypto. So, it's really amazing. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Facebook Libra and what they're doing. We're, like, kind of the first kind of big competitor to Facebook Libra. So, if you don't know, Facebook is just trying to basically take control over the monetary system of the world, which I think is really scary. They've gotten fucking brutalized in DC, and, you know, we want to counter that and be a little bit not like evil technocrat about it, but actually do something good with it. But MetalPay, it's a super easy way to get into crypto. The company is run by a guy named Marshall Hainer, and Marshall is a absolute motherfucking genius in all that stuff. So yeah, I decided to, I'm now, I consider myself a very hands-on investor. I come into the office every day and I'm at the office now.
Erica, awesome. Do you believe in, or do you lean on the great man theory of history, which I think was brought to fruition by the philosopher Thomas Carlyle, which talks about how the most important historical events are brought on not by some kind of a mass agreement, but by certain individuals that find their place in history and are able to use whatever position they get into in order to change history, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse?
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I remember when I was 3 years old, I kind of had that mindset. Was my very first thought or my very first question and insight about myself was I asked my mom, just 3 years, it's like my very first memory. I said, why am I looking out of my eyes and not yours or anybody else's? And then my mom was just like, I just kind of is. And then kind of just is that way. And then when I heard that, I was like, wow, I guess if I'm looking out of my eyes, I must be looking out of my eyes for a reason. You know, I must be a chosen one, right?
Yeah, then, why was I born in this life as opposed to another one?
Exactly. And I think, although I intellectually maybe don't believe that, you know, that, but I think emotionally and in my mindset, that always stuck with me, that, you know, I was destined for greatness. And I still have a ways to go. But, you know, I haven't done too bad in my life.
How old are you? You're 20 years old?
I'm 20 years old. I'm an old man. So I think that's been good. Wow. And then I, got into Bitcoin when I'm 12 years old, and 15, dropped out of high school, had about $100,000 in Bitcoin, used that to start a company, sold that company at 17, used that to, made a real life Dr. Octopus robotic suit, launched a satellite with people, time caps on it, with people like Taylor Swift contributing to it, and all that. And then, I've launched some other cool crypto projects and invested in the Metal Pay. So it's been a life. So I don't think I've done too bad. I feel like I still have, you know, people say life is short. I feel like life has felt very long for me. I guess I'm like, I've kind of lived a life. I've, you know, had, dated a lot of great people, you know, launched a lot of cool projects, made a lot of good money. It's like, although I'm very happy, it's like, you know, it's like, if I got hit by a bus, I wouldn't be like, and I'm just on the street, you know, bleeding out. And I'm like, you know, I've lived a long enough life.
Jules wants to live forever, or at least as long as possible, when it comes to the life extension Wakanda tech that may be hidden from us.
Well, you know, that's a way of phrasing it. He's mocking me.
No, I'm not mocking you, Jules. I believe in that. I also want to live for as long as possible. And I think that people should be given that opportunity. My big fear, though, is that we have a lot of super rich people who want to hoard a lot of advanced technology for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think that does happen.
Well, I think the emerging life extension tech, I think whatever does exist, whatever breakthroughs exist, I doubt there's hoarding going on. I guess we don't know what the Pentagon spends so much money on stuff. They could have stuff for like fast healing wounds in the battlefield, and who knows the kind of stuff that DARPA thinks up. And but aging is an engineering problem. So I saw your Dr. Octopus suit on Mashable.
Oh, wow.
It was awesome.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
So it's a one-size-fits-all suit?
Yeah, we made it for, it was for a young guy. So, we kind of made it for that. But I could turn it on, it works, you know, and all that. We'd probably make it a little bit bigger. It was kind of made for a child that just felt like that he would have the best use case for it. It worked on, I wore it, but I'd probably make it, if I were to do it again, I'd make a bigger one. I plan to do it. It's on my little list of things to do. Was if I put another 20K into it, which isn't a lot actually, if for robotic stuff, put another 20K into it, I could have it lift a car. So it would have like two arms, like it's not at that stage yet, but if I put another 20K, two arms, you know, bracing you, and the other two arms lifting it, it could lift a, you know, smart car or even a Prius, you know, so, it could totally do that. I just need to like 20K in a lot more time, but I've been so busy.
Sounds like a lot. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money to, I know relatively speaking, it's
20K, you know, for robotics is like fucking nothing, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
Like, I built that Dr. Octopus suit for $5,000 that you see on Mashable. Like that's like pretty unbelievable.
That's really impressive. That looked like a lot of small parts, like a lot of,
cause it was all mainly 3D printed. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. That was awesome. We're going to show that up. We're going to pull that up. You're interested in politics a little bit. What is, cause how long have you been interested in politics, and what's your view on the state of things? You can answer that as specifically or vaguely as you like, but I am very interested.
Yeah, I think since birth I've been passionate about politics. So I love politics. I was like fucking reading, you know, just politics sections since I was like 6 years old. Like I loved it. I was a news junkie, totally, and still am a news junkie. I absolutely love, I'm fascinated by politics. I don't like love, you know, I think what I love about politics is I love about what could happen to politics. I don't think I love politics currently or love politics, but the potential, I think I don't love everything in the world today, but I love the potential of what the world could be. And I think for my views on the world today, I mean, I think Trump, you know, kind of ended up being mediocre. You know, I think that was kind of a little bit of a false start, if you will. I mean, I think Obama and Trump were these like really like come in, you had the audacity to bring in just massive change, and neither of them really did it. And I think that was very disappointing. So, you know, it's kind of the people, you know, like them or hate them, you know, people have fucked up the system and neither of them have really done it. But I think it shows that the mood is in that type of thing of just absolutely massive change. And then people tried Obama and then that didn't end up working out. Like, you know, what did Obama do? Like Obamacare kinda, right? Mm-hmm. And Trump kinda probably how a lot of people felt about Obama in like 2012, just like just kinda you know, was you know, people think of him as this truly evil demagogue or this, you know, God upon high or whatever. But I actually just think he's kind of like, you know, how would he have been that different than like Jeb Bush, you know? Oh, I guess, you know, no, I think that's, no. Nah, I think that I go, how would he have, Jeb Bush promised to pull out of the climate accord, you know, maybe tariffs, you know, I think maybe, you know, Trump has bombed Syria, you know, Trump is, I think tariffs are really the only thing that would have been slightly different on. I think he's loud. I think he says things, but an actual like policy action, how would he have been that different than Jeb? I think that.
Well, versus Jeb Bush, we have the border control situation, which if Trump wasn't blocked in his attempts, and who knows, we may still see a wall. And as far as what that means in the future, it's difficult for me to say, but I think that the one responsibility that the federal government has at the least is with border security.
Yeah, I think you gotta, you know, I think you gotta have a border, absolutely. But I don't think you'll ever get a wall, is my point. I don't think we'll ever get a wall. That's my pessimistic belief.
Well, he's building the wall. He's building the wall right now.
Is it a wall really though?
I can't even fathom comparing Trump to Jeb. First of all, Trump has done a lot to stall concentration of power abroad. So even though like I'm a libertarian, I'm anti-tariff in theory, but mm-hmm. in practice, like pragmatically, we have to look at the reality of the entanglement of our system currently. And China is trying to, I mean, this is an exaggeration, is trying to swallow us like an amoeba, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think China's Trump,
the biggest threat this country has is terrible.
Yeah, and I think Trump has actually done a lot, like fighting.
China, I agree. Trump has killed the game on China. I really love what he's doing with China. That's why I like tariffs and all that stuff. I think I'm very pro, and that's something that you're right is different. China is a huge, massive threat to the U.S. And China's honestly smart. They're smart. They're acting smart. Like, why doesn't the U.S. You know, you look with China. They're able to. You know, they're saying, hey, if you're a business that wants to do business in China, you have to be pro-China, right? And, you know, the U.S. doesn't have the balls to do that, and that's disappointing. You know, you got to have some, you know, I think that's so important. But yeah, I love what Trump is doing with China. I absolutely agree with you on that.
Well, what the U.S. Citizens don't have the balls to do is what the people in Hong Kong are doing right now when it comes to standing up for the civil liberties that like with us, I remember back in the day when I was touring the film festival circuit, I started out as an animator. I attended the Woodstock Film Festival where an animation of mine was playing. And I remember freaking out over the authorization act that Obama passed, which enabled people to be locked up indefinitely. And I didn't understand why nobody else was freaking out about this. But, you know, Obama was their guy. And recently we've seen that news with Ellen DeGeneres sitting down with George W. Bush and how this whole thing just seems to be prearranged to get people into this very obedient, subservient mindset, which is very different from people in Hong Kong who I think really value this rare thing that they were able to get and they don't want to let go of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's do or die for Hong Kong as like a city state, right? Like it's either going to be as remain a city state, or maybe even go independent like Taiwan, or, you know, be a part of China. You know, it's do or die.
Taiwan and Hong Kong are done. They're done. That's China's now.
I think I agree. I think China will win in the Hong Kong battle, unless Trump has the balls to do something, but I kind of doubt it.
He's doing a lot. So it's not like we don't want armed conflict. We don't want armed conflict. I think that would be ugly. I think that'd be really ugly.
I agree.
Well, you were talking before about how it's wise to invest in Saudi Arabia and invest in China right now. The one thing that I don't know, and I am by no means an expert at this, but I've been seeing reports about a lot of Chinese people who are getting loans, buying up real estate in other countries. I mm-hmm. don't know how secure they feel with the future of their own country. I don't feel secure about the future of a country who has this oligarchic top-down rule. Like, I don't think that that is a recipe for long-term success. I could be wrong about this, but in terms of, you know, just imagining the planet Earth being under some kind of a social credit system, AI, world government stage, if this whole thing, and this is me getting a little bit metaphysical here, if this whole thing was a simulation of a God's mind or whatever, that kind of world would get hit by the meteor pretty fast.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I said that because I agree with it. I think that the top down, although I don't think it's moral, I think that they do I think China's doing a great job for China, in my opinion. And I think China, you know, they don't have the fears, right? They're going into Africa, right? Where, you know, the West is, you know, has to kind of sneakily do that through like US aid programs, which is really the purpose of these programs. Is just a purse to be able to buy stuff. But I mean, China just has no problem doing it. They have kind of a blend of communist and capitalist, right? I do think China is expansionist, and I think China will actually do well, and I think China is probably doing better than the West is doing. And I think, you know, these people want to grow. You know, China wants to grow. Saudi in the Middle East, they want to grow, you know?
I think that's true.
They're on the down cycle. And I think that can be fixed and it can be changed. But right now the momentum is, you know, on the downswing, right? And I think that's where you get people like Obama and Trump, which are kind of responses to that. And I think you're going to get it more radical every time, you know? If Obama doesn't do the job, you're going to get Trump. If Trump doesn't do the job, you're going to get someone more radical.
The bigger question for me is grow for the sake of what? If it's just grow for the sake of growth as far as continuing mindless expansion just so that people live in a certain way, I think that if we don't have certain moral questions to ask, certain questions about what are we really living here for, like that's why I think a lot of these great world religions were created for thousands of years, because I don't think you can separate people from that no matter how hard you try. And if you do, then you're just going to create a bunch of mindless drones, and you don't even have to call it religion. Like, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but this idea that there is something greater than you, than just whatever it is that you happen to want to buy at a particular time. This may also be a reason why Americans feel kind of demoralized today, and why our culture, unless we're talking about the aforementioned internet intellectuals, seems to be kind of on the decline.
Well, we have religious freedom, right? Is China atheist? Or I'm an atheist, by the way. So
I think China, you can be whatever religion you want. Except, I mean, I know that they put, you might know better than this, but I mean, they put Muslims in camps, maybe not, but they're secular. So
I heard about that. They're doing horrific stuff over there. They're like
organ harvesting.
Yeah, it's terrible. No, they're what you call a statheists. So they're an atheist, so they just create a state.
I like that. I never heard that.
Kind of funny. But it's all about China, nationalized. But they have the bigger than them thing that they have is China, national identity, right? And I guess the Middle East or Saudi, I think they have some national identity, but it's more in religion and all that. It's more of a Muslim thing, where China's more of a country thing.
I could understand that somewhat, but at the same time, even when there are certain nationalistic principles that we see in countries, I can't really separate a lot of the non-atheistic ones from the idea of transcendence from the human form that we're currently occupying. Like, I don't know, like I happen to believe and I'd be interested to hear your take on it. I mm-hmm. believe in reincarnation. I believe that we're all undergoing various tests in this solipsistic worldview that you mentioned that you were born in, where I imagine a similar thing. Like each of us is a separate universe that's experiencing reality. And when we're talking with you right now, three universes are colliding together and we're mm-hmm. both affecting our individual timeline, so to speak, mm-hmm. in this multi-word scenario. But I think that if people don't have that in a basic form, like I come from Russia and there people had that for a long time, but they were also serfs and they were taught back in the Middle Ages to say a prayer for the Khan and his family. So mm-hmm. I could definitely see how religion could be used to manipulate people. But without that aspect, like you were also mentioning about the Rajneesh organization.
Oh, yes. Rajneesh Param.
Yeah, Rajneesh Param. Like, if you don't have that kind of togetherness that could manifest itself as Rajneesh, but could also manifest itself as Om Shinrikyo. I don't know how familiar you are with that organization, but that was a cult in Japan that was responsible for the sarin gas attacks in Tokyo. So that's an example of, like, this very influential guy who was able to steer people into the wrong direction.
Well, and all of, so everybody in the Om Shinrikyo cult, they were all like masters in physics and chemistry and engineers. Okay. So like all of the people in it were hyper educated.
Wow.
And highly skilled. So it wasn't like a bunch of tumbleweeds in a trailer park or something.
Well, that was Rajneesh Param was like too. I mean, it was all like lawyers and really high yuppies effectively, but really smart yuppies was.
Bohemians. It was yuppies. They're definitely, it was like from bohemians to yuppies for sure.
I think it was yuppies that kind of became bohemian. I guess they got, kind of showcased at least in the documentary that these were like really capitalistic smart people that, you know, that went to do this. At least that was it. And then they kind of really became bohemian. And then, you know, then they brought in other people and probably some were just hippies and all that. But it was really interesting. It's really interesting. And what's interesting about China as well is, you know, like the mayor of Shanghai or the mayor of Beijing are both engineers. Like they just appoint the mayor. And I don't know if that's moral, but they just appoint the mayor. Like mayor of Shanghai is just an environmental engineer with a PhD. Like that's, you know. And then I see some mayors in the U.S., like back in my hometown, just really like crappy mayors that hate progress, that don't do anything, right? It's just like crazy. And I don't think, I'm very pro-democracy, but also just we need to elevate, what is it? I guess we need to elevate the smart people. Like a lot of smart people, they're like engineer, like environmental engineer would never win an election, you know, but you need to, I think that'd be great. I think there's this pack that's trying to like get engineers and physicists and really smart people to help them win elections, because they're very bad at the marketing, but they're very good at the policy and very good at what they do, but they're bad at the marketing. And I think that's something that needs to be fixed.
Who do you love in politics? Who do you love in politics right now? And who do you hate in politics or strongly dislike?
I don't hate anybody. You know, I have like my own political beliefs and all that stuff, so I can hate people. But I've changed my thinking of, I think more about who plays politics best and all that. So I think there was the last love that I've had was I was fascinated. Again, I don't even know what his politics are. But Emmanuel Macron, I found to be very fascinating. The way he talked about just, you know, the Jupiterian, I'm butchering that. I think I said this in the last podcast, the Jupiterian or Jupiterian grandness of being the president of the French Republic. And I thought that was very interesting. But he was also somebody that I feel like knows the importance of being the president of the French Republic, the larger than lifeness that comes with that, but doesn't really exercise it appropriately. So I feel like that's, I don't know. I feel like when I see all these, I might mention this in the other podcast as well, but like I saw just all these like Democrat candidates eating fucking hot dogs, you know, corn dogs at the Ohio State Fair, you know, and flipping burgers and all that. And I'm like, oh my God. And I hate that. I hate Republicans, Democrats just doing this. Like being president is this larger than life. You should be larger than life. You're a leader. And then, you know, like slurping down corn dogs, you know, as good as they may be, who knows, is pretty just
I love corn dogs.
No, I love corn dogs too, but I feel like it's just the I loved, and I don't really love Macron anymore to the fullest extent, at least as of now. I didn't really follow him much in his election. I just saw he came on the stage and whatever. But, you know, you can look at him, oh, you know, he's pro-EU, or, and then there's, you know, they like the anti-EU. But I'm just looking at him from a pure brand and what is the energy that they bring to the table. And Macron had a really good energy of larger-than-lifeness and, the, you know, being the president of the French Republic. And I loved it. But I don't think he exercised it. He knows the value of the office, but doesn't know that. And I just wish we would, that's what I want in a U.S. president, is someone that is just like, gets it, you know, is larger than life, isn't somebody that you would eat a corn dog with, but is somebody that is like, just.
Are you voting Kanye? Are you voting Kanye 2024?
We'll see. I'm excited. I'm up for it. I'm excited. I think Kanye would run the most fun campaign, not even as a joke, but like with the Sunday services that he's doing. It would be the most inspirational campaign ever, in my opinion.
Really, you attended a service, right?
I did. I did attend a Sunday service. It was great. And it was like, I fucking cried. It was beautiful. It would be the most best campaign. But I think this is where I learned with Obama and Trump is, you know, you can have the best campaign in the world, but that's a lot different when you become president. And I feel like, you know, I thought there'd be all this massive change and massive like restructuring, you know, everything overnight, and maybe that's unrealistic.
There's been huge change. You haven't noticed huge change? You haven't noticed huge change?
And again, maybe you'll be mad at me. I haven't, there's been change, but there isn't like massive systemic, I want the whole country to change overnight. And I guess it has. And I think that's actually realistic. I think if you have a president that had the balls to know what they were doing.
Not a blackout or something. It's like, I think
you could do it, man. I think you could do it.
The Rajneesh story, the Wild Wild Country story, is really interesting as like a model for what seasteading could be or something.
I agree. Think
that I'm very interested in Peter Thiel's politics, and he's a Trump supporter. He's a libertarian. Mm-hmm. People try to smear him online. They say he's like the dark enlightenment or something. And I think he's really just about common sense, localism, and I think he's a lot of government red tape as inhibitive to a lot of progress. And so we were talking about life extension earlier. I think that's what Peter Thiel's like hyper focused on. I think him and even Elon Musk, I think
life extension is totally achievable. I think being able to live forever or not die through old age. I mean, you know, you get hit by a bus, right? But I think that's totally achievable in our lifetime, where you basically stop aging and can live a very long time.
I can imagine like DVDs, it would get cheaper over time. But then there is this idea that probably some people have of, you know, there are too many people in the world, we're not going to be able to provide for everybody. Why don't we just have everybody else live like the Hunger Games underclass while we get to take advantage of it? And I don't know when it comes to these higher circles of power, if people are interested in making everything way cheaper so that we could all afford to get this tech while others are, as I formerly described.
Yeah, and you have the moral question of, you know, you have some bad people in the world and they get technology to live forever, you know, that's right. And then two, like just the change of sometimes even good people, it's the old guard and switching with the new guard. I don't know, it's a moral question I have to ask myself, you know, it's hard. If you have the technology for everyone to live forever, you know, and have people's moms and daughters and brothers and sisters live forever, but then also sometimes it's good for people to kind of die, you know, just through old age and have a new guard come in.
It'd be better to replace people that no longer provide good, you know, leadership or something. We're talking, because I hear people say, oh, with life extension, dictators will live forever. That's like one of the zingers. I think the strongest argument for the pro-aging trance is eventual overpopulation. I don't think we're anywhere close to overpopulation. People talk about overpopulation now. I think we could easily triple our population just in tandem with more progress in Moore's law. You know, like we keep increasing our crop yields with genetic engineering. I know some people are more skeptical of GMOs than others. I eat GMOs. Like I have no superstition about GMOs. Mm-hmm. I think that they're trying to cycle bugs into our diet. A lot of these extremely online people, so the autistic mercury, they're convinced that social engineers, like PR specialists, are trying to popularize bugs to fulfill this communist underclass Lev was talking about. But I think just pragmatically, you know, the more things people are willing to eat, you know, when you go from 8 billion to 16 billion to 24 billion people on the planet, those little cultural shifts can make a world of difference. So that's why you see in Michelin restaurants, you have chefs like
crazy
expertly putting bugs into their dishes. Yeah, well, you know, a cricket. I eat a cricket. I've seen some stuff.
I've eaten a cricket before too, like a little Cheeto cricket. I've had one.
Little Cheeto cricket. Yeah, I'd have. Yeah.
I know. I went to a restaurant with bugs. It was honestly not that. It wasn't disgusting, but it wasn't anything impressive. You know,
yeah, well, really they're not bad, right? But it's just like.
I've never had a cricket. I have to have a cricket.
You said, you just had a cricket, dude.
No, I said I would have one. I would have one.
You can get Cheeto dust crickets, like dried crickets. I've eaten one.
Where?
In my, like, my teacher back in, like, high school brought them to for all of us.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, fuck it. Eat it and it tasted like a Cheeto.
Yeah. I had chocolate-covered ants. It just tastes like chocolate. It was like a raisin. It was kind of like a raisinette.
And here we are popularizing the eating of bugs surreptitiously, pretending like we don't, but really that's our mission. But but Eric, if you were to gain political power, what are some things that you're mulling over in your head of what would you want to do?
This is where I'm always constantly evaluating and things like this is where I thought a lot about it, but also Aristotle, you know, I know what I don't know. So I think that's things. But I think using the coding bootcamp business model, which is taking a percentage of your salary for education, I think that's something that should be applied across all schools. So I think you can make all schools completely free, all colleges completely free, but not having to spend a single taxpayer dollar, actually even spending less taxpayer money, giving teachers more money because you're actually making money. And then, yeah, so that would be something I would do to the whole education system, you know?
So explain that. That sounds really interesting. So how would that work?
So, yeah, I mean, so yeah, there's these coding boot camps in various schools that exist today, but they're, you know, it's not widespread, where they, you know, you join the school, they teach you how to code. And then, you know, they, you know, it's completely free for the student and they just charge the corporate company that hires you, 10% of your first year salary. So if you're making like $120K, you know, they'll take 10% of that per year, right? So they'll take $12,000? $12,000, $24,000 in total, right? So it's your cost of tuition. And usually the corporate company, sometimes they take it out of the salary or sometimes they just pay it on top of the salary, right? So I think that's a way, you know, how can you do these things? Like I think progressives have the right idea, but I just think the wrong way to go about them. I think free university is absolutely a great, brilliant idea and is a very important investment in your country and in your people. It's really an investment. And I think you could flip a switch and then convert, pay teachers more, give students a better experience, and three, you know, pay way less, add way more to the budget because education is a huge part of the budget. And this way you're actually making money by doing it, by like getting people hired, right? So I think that's would be one of the first things that I would do to the education system. And that I think is just a win-win-win-win. Teachers are getting paid more, students are getting better, more creating more jobs. And then, you know, you would act as a good job facilitator. Also, there's things that I'm playing around with that I'm not sure, you know, Bernie had a jobs for all, you know, type of policy, it's like you have a job no matter what. I think that that's a little bit socialistic, but I actually think if you did it right, you could combine that with a tax cut, where you say, if you hire this person, your taxes go down X amount, right? So you say, if you're at AT&T, you hire 10,000 people, or even if you're a small business, you hire 10 people, your taxes go down X amount. So that way you kind of have a tax cut in exchange for jobs, right? So in the end, you're probably still paying out the same, but at least you're able to hire people. And I don't know, that's an idea that I'm not sure about, but one that I'm playing around with that I find to be interesting. So the education one is something that I've thought a lot about it and something I would definitely do. But there's other things like, yeah, can you effectively employ everyone in the United States while lowering taxes at the same time? Like, I feel like that's a very fascinating concept, and all that. So,
on the subject of education, something I've learned, a lot of the teachers at universities, they're really administrators. So, like, mm-hmm. let's say the ratio of staff to students at a school could be like you have 8 teachers per 1 student or 5 teachers per 1 student. Mm-hmm. But what's really going on is, you know, like 70 to 90% of that is administration. And mm-hmm. so people that are never in the classroom with a student, right? People who are in many cases just in make work jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that comes from how the schools are subsidized, because they get mm-hmm. this surplus of money. They know mm-hmm. that they'll have scholarships come in. And then they also know that, you know, people are continuing to pay these exorbitant tuition fees. Mm-hmm. So what do they spend it on? You mm-hmm. know, and it's like a nightclub business right mm-hmm. now, where a lot of the value for higher education comes from like limiting people access, right? Mm-hmm. So you go to a nightclub, they have the velvet rope. They want people waiting outside the club trying to get in. And mm-hmm. that's what gives the club the value. And I think colleges operate the same way. And because if they were really generating that value, the conversation would be, how do we scale that? Like, okay, one person goes through our doors and after 4 years, they're USDA prime college educated, you know, how do we replicate this kind of outcome? And then you could just scale it, like open up more schools, you know, like replicate the program. But that's not how it works. It's a lot like, it's just about signaling, I think, mm-hmm. is what a lot of colleges are. And I think providing free education is possible with the type of innovations you're talking about, and just with a cultural shift in terms mm-hmm. of demystifying the perceived authority of higher education. Because it's not always the best shortcut for what's in a person's head. I mean, if you can direct people online to and praise self-educated autodidacts and people mm-hmm. like that, I think you could really add a real spark to our culture. Yeah, overnight change. So how would that? So if Trump were to implement something like that, mm-hmm. where would the overnight change come from? Like, what do you think would be a good overnight change for education, if it's possible?
I think exactly what I said. I think doing something like that. I think mm-hmm. switching everything, and then, you know, I think probably you're going to have to remodel a lot of schools. I would set up huge, with the money that you save by not having to spend money on education, you know, on kind of the whole system, right? Because now you're making money, right? You can use that money to remodel all schools to make them modern and interesting. And then, yeah, I mean, I would go in, and what Common Core did poorly, I would do that successfully, where you come in at the Department of Education level and just start remodeling schools, paying teachers more, switch to this business model. You can even have off ramps for more liberal arts things as well. So you're not just because you'll have people complain, well, is this just for the free market? You know, you're just going to appeal to free market job listings or whatever. No, I think you could have, you know, set actually a good path for incredible art programs that actually make money, you know, and you could set that all up, right? So I think that's how you do it. I mean, it would take like a few months of prep if you were smart about it, and then, you know, you do it overnight, right? So I think that's something that I would do. And I think I really like, again, I don't know if it's for sure, maybe someone can tell me if I'm wrong, I really like the idea of lowering taxes for people that hire more. I like the idea.
I think all lowering tax ideas are generally good, probably, as a rule of thumb. I really actually think that.
No, I agree with that. And I think that's because I really liked what I thought the Republicans, it was a smart marketing move when they, you know, lowered taxes for companies that, you know, these, look, we're now with the lower taxes, we're raising everything to a $15 minimum wage, right? So I thought that was interesting, just voluntarily. So I thought that was an interesting marketing move. So I think you could do the same where, you know, we're going to be lowering taxes. And then if you hire people or raise your wages, or just hiring people, I think, and then, yeah, you get to, I want to get to zero. I would want to get to 0% unemployment rate. I thought there was a funny joke. It was a Tosh.0 and it was like, or it was like an Onion article or something. It was like, you know, man, you know, president amazed that 90% of American 90+% Americans are employed. Isn't that amazing? Like most people think about the 7 to 8% unemployment rate or whatever it is, right? Unemployment rates. And it was funny to be like, I'm just amazed that 90+% of Americans have like found a job. Like that's, that was a terrible joke, but it was funny.
I guess I would just be a little bit careful when it comes to the amount of people employed without that employment having any kind of purpose, like it was in the USSR. Because back there, there was zero unemployment. Everybody had a job, but most of those jobs, they paid almost next to nothing.
And well, those were government jobs, correct? Yeah. These would be free market jobs. So, you know, maybe they just, you know, hire somebody to do nothing, you know, for the tax break, right? Or two, you know, they end up go, well, you know, we have these people anyways, we'll just put them for something, you know? I think that's kind of how it'll probably go down, you know? And then, yeah, I mean, you would set up systems like if they were like bad, you know, that you could just, you know, do something with them, right? You could transfer them or whatever, right?
Efficiency would be very important in this case.
Exactly. But you'd still have the market incentives to keep it efficient in the system is my belief. You know, though it doesn't. So anyways, that's kind of my point. But that's how I would lower it to 0% unemployment. But again, I'm not sure. I have to talk to people that are smarter than
me. I think that plan sounds like a good start. It might need some good tinkering. Start. It might need some tinkering.
Yeah, you would. It's one of those things where you have to like put a if this then that. You know, a lot of if statements, right? that you would have to do.
So you like Mark Khan, you like Bernie, you like Republicans. So what's,
no, I don't. Bernie, no, I don't like anybody. You know, I don't like anybody. I don't hate anybody. I take what I like out of different groups of people. You know, and all that.
AOC as well. Like I remember you were mentioning that she was one of the politicians who gets it today.
Lately I just saw her being pro bombing Syria and all that. So I don't know about that today. I feel she's definitely done
it. Any sense.
I talk. People get confused. It's like I'm still developing what my political beliefs are. I know that they're not Democrat. I know that they're not Republican. I know I just want to look and figure things out for myself. And when I say I like a candidate, I say like, oh, AOC is interesting from a politics point of view. Mm-hmm. Interesting how she came, you know, from bar, you know, her story is interesting. Bartender to, you know, now the hottest politician. And
yeah, she's huge.
That's an inspirational story too. Just how she came onto the scene and just how she's tweeting and how she is politically. But yeah, I mean, you know, has she bent the knee now? Who knows, you know, or maybe she's fine. I don't know. But I thought that was interesting. And then, yeah, I'm just fascinated by people in the political scene. So, yeah, am I Democrat? Am I Republican? I mean, you know, what does that even mean?
Right? You said independent or libertarian.
I don't want to even use any labels. You know, it's just Eric Finman is my label.
Eric Finman, that's better. It's better that way.
Exactly.
I agree. I think that that's a good view to have to study people and see what are the things that are the spiciest right now. Why did they become so damn spicy?
Exactly.
And I definitely see that quality, regardless of me disagreeing with a lot of her policies. I see that in AOC or the Squad or wherever these movements are that take people, because it's a study in how people work, what people react to. And I think that that could be used both for good as well as evil.
I agree. And that's why I think if you can learn these good techniques and these dark arts techniques for doing something when I, you know, I'm 20, I'm still developing everything and my thinking on everything and use those. But yeah, I just figure what made this spicy. And I think that's a very good way to put it. And that's what I look at when I look at candidates. But for actually political policy, I actually want to do, like, I want to take a statistics class. I want to just like learn. I want to talk to the smartest people, you know, in these spaces and just talk to everybody. And that's my goal for next year in 2020 is just to like spend a lot, but also spend a lot of time just learning and talking to people and listening.
Do you think eventually you'll pull a Gautama Buddha And after you've accomplished all of this stuff, you go out into nature, sit down, start meditating, and reach enlightenment. Like, that seems to be like the ultimate level for whatever it is you get to do in life after you've accomplished everything else.
I'll probably just die at my desk, to be honest. That's probably how I'm going to go. I'm going to work till I'm dead, but that's because I just love what I'm doing so much. I'm going to not work till I'm dead or die at my desk. I'm going to give my last breath doing what I love. And I think that's a nicer way to put it.
That's very powerful. It's definitely something to look up to.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. No, it's I really enjoy just really enjoying life. I love it.
I mean, I don't see enough of that. Mm. And I think it fills my heart and my spirit when I see youth like you. And it gives me hope for the future. Because
how old are you again?
I'm 30.
You're 30, no shit.
I'm 30, yeah.
I'm 30. 32. I'm We're both there. 30-year-old boomers.
Wow.
I'm not a boomer, bro.
You guys look younger than 30. You guys look good.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. I wish I was 20, bro.
Dude, you look like you're 20. Like
Thank you.
You look a really good 20.
Thank you. It's the camera, everybody. Thank you.
You'd be a good actor for Beverly Hills 90210. You know, like they cast their...
He would. I could totally see that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm soaking this in right now. Thank you. That's good.
By the way, Eric, out of curiosity, have you ever heard of crypto art?
Crypto art? Is that like the comic guy? Like he posts these comics?
No. So I recently, like a year ago, got involved with making art on the blockchain.
Wait, was that the... Oh, yeah. Okay, never mind. You go.
So there's different websites out there. They're super rare. There's known origin. And I was attending this festival at the Bushwick Generator in Brooklyn called Rare AF, where I had my Andrew Yang crypto art piece that was auctioned there. And what I don't know is what exactly the future would be for, like before we were talking about education, and then you were steering it into the realm of culture. And as far as the art that people are exposed to, I remember you were talking about there being card systems with Magic the Gathering in the Autistic Mercury podcast being linked to crypto tokens that people can invest in. Do you see something like that happening in the future as far as there being new Da Vinci's and Michelangelo's whose content the Medici's of the world would be able to invest in and thereby usher in a new artistic renaissance?
I think having good art is one of the most important things and something I want to think about more of how do you make artists more money, you know? Like, and I think that's why I've been thinking about the education system. Like, art is so important to me, and I think art... I'm particularly passionate about film and music and all that, but no, I totally think blockchain and cryptocurrency has incredible applications for providing more money to artists. I think that's one of the most, you got to look like, I'm very pro, thank you. I'm very pro STEM and all that, but you know, I'm very, I think art is the things that, you know, keeps this country and the world alive. You know, I think what, you know, how many, you know, Star Trek, right? Art that inspired so many, you know, young people. You know, I don't think you would have Alexa today if not for, you know, the Star Trek kind of film and that. I mean, it's just such such beauty things, beautiful things. I think film and music, my personal artistic passions, art is one of the most important things and the things that really define ourselves as a people and as a country and as a world. So I want to, you know, I think blockchain, yeah, it does have incredible opportunities to make artists more money. And that's something I actually want to work on at some point in the future.
What's some of your favorite music? Some of your favorite bands or some of your favorite music?
Kanye West is my number one favorite and all that. So I think that's been good. Here, let me look. You know, I'm going to get made fun of for this, but some of Macklemore's songs are actually good.
Macklemore.
Yeah, it's Macklemore, actually. So for those... Kanye... you know, I'm pretty basic white dude. You know, Travis Scott, Tyler the Creator, Chance the Rapper, Kanye, Pusha T, you know, that whole group. But my music things change yet. Charlie XCX put out a really fucking amazing album. Loved it. And you should go check out Charlie XCX. It's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. But yeah, I really love what Kanye's doing with the Sunday services and all that. So I think that's just inspirational.
You're in a rap. And so no K-pop.
No K-pop. I haven't really listened to K-pop, so maybe I'm missing out.
It's very addictive. If you ever get into Twice, you can't stop listening.
What's that? Yeah, is that the famous K-pop band? What's the really famous one?
I believe it is Twice. It was created by JYP, and I think it has like 8 girls in. I don't know. You know, they're all cute and dolled up and all that. But I think there is something in the algorithm of their music that gets people very invested into it. But beyond that, like, I don't know if you've ever heard of Japanese city pop, but I recently got into that. It's this music that was made in Japan during the late 80s. And I think it also reflected what was going on at the time when their economy was very high on the hog. So Somebody left a comment afterwards in one of the videos where they were saying that now that after the crash that happened in Japan, people didn't even want to look back at that music because it just made them sad. You know, made them sad for all those good times that they had back then. But in a way, like, I see that music being resurgent again with people who feel like they have a nostalgia for a time and a country that they never really lived in. And I think it's something that it speaks to me too, that there are these different flavors, thanks to the internet, of a completely different thing that we never grew up with, that we could grab onto and maybe tool around with it and make something completely new out of it. Like, I think that people are starving for culture and they're getting it from these very interesting, unexpected sources. I mean, look at 4chan and Japanese culture, for instance. And that brought about Pepe the Frog in a way, and a lot of these, and now Pepe the Frog is being used in Hong Kong. So yeah. I'm very fascinated by all these mimetic influences. And do you see memes as also being a part of art?
Oh yeah, I've had many conversations about that. I mean, you know, propaganda, art, memes, I mean, they all go hand in hand. I think memes are the, I look at a painting when I was younger and I go, I don't even get this painting, right? But I feel like a painting is, yeah, just a little, it is a meme. You know, I guess a young person growing up with memes more so than paintings, I go, oh, paintings are just like memes, you know? And then now I see like, oh, well, memes are pretty much just like paintings, you know, because paintings were first. And I feel like there's, because, you know, there's these paintings from back in the day that were just culturally relevant that, yeah, I don't even get because I don't get the joke. It's the inside joke, right? Mm-hmm. Like I saw this meme and it was like, oh, when you're trying to, you know, when your friend sees you're laughing at a meme, but, you know, it's a 7th level internet meme, so I can't even begin to explain it or something like that. You know, so it's just like, that's what I feel like a lot of paintings are. It's just like, oh, I don't get the inside joke. I don't get the meme. I'm not like a 7th layer into this. But I think if you look at memes as art, I think that's fascinating.
A lot of painting movements have a dialogue, so to speak.
They do. That's a good way to put it. Dialogue is a really good word for it.
And I like thinking of memes as like new Dadaism. And a lot, you know, Dadaism, found art, right? That guy put a urinal in a museum. Yes. That's Dadaism. So it's literally found art. Like, I found this on the street and now I've brought it into a museum and like I put Dada on it and now it's a high art piece. And so Dada is...
Well, I think that was the urinal thing. People point to that it was making fun of that almost. It was ironic to do it that way. So that was the art. People think of that, oh, look at this modern art and that's shitty. But like that was the irony of the urinal. It was funny.
See, I think like you, but people take Dadaism seriously. Like you'll meet some people and there's no satire. You're like, this is satire, right? You're like, this is satire. And then people are like, no, Dadaism. Like, think about it intellectually. Like, because a lot of modern art feels like, oh, I could have done that, but I didn't, right? Mm-hmm. A lot, if you look at a Mondrian painting, it's squares. Now, technically, like Mondrian, like those lines are straight. Like those squares, those aren't easy paintings to replicate. Like if I tried to forge a Mondrian painting, it wouldn't look anywhere close. Mm-hmm. Right? Like you'd be able to tell immediately, like this is not a Mondrian. Like the craft isn't there. A lot of those paintings made it. Like they had their moments, and it's, and not just flash pan moments. Like they resonate within our global consciousness as part of our art history. It was the manifestos they had with the art. It was the ideas behind the art. So the artist would say, this is what inspired me. This is what the art is all about. Now look at my red square.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then it's, you know, it's not like a Michelangelo. It's not like a Da Vinci, but it's supposed
to be dialogue to it. Yeah.
It's the dialogue to it.
But now it feels to me at least kind of stale, where you have this artistic establishment that's just brown nosing themselves over these pieces that some of them ended up getting thrown out by the janitorial staff because they thought it was literal garbage. You know, like I think there has to be a return to things that are more challenging, not just, oh, I didn't think of doing this, but this is way beyond whatever it is that I could do. So I'm going to stare at awe at this particular thing. And there was this one picture that I saw of this fat lady who was taking off her robe, showing her body off. And that was also supposed to be some kind of a feminist statement. And there were these Zoomer kids that were looking at her. One of the kids was just like, he was absolutely disinterested at what was going on. Why am I here? Why am I looking at this fat lady? You know, like there is nothing that I can connect with here. And people have commented on how that photo that was taken is a representation of these millennial versus Generation Z differences, where I think that Gen Z, other than maybe being a bit more conservative than the previous generation, is able to call BS on some of the things that millennials take very sacrosanct, take as if it's beyond criticism.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess you just had millennia of just very traditional professional art, right? And I guess in the past, you know, 100 years or so, or less than 100 years, you know, I guess it's just been the modern art just trying to upend those norms. And I think, honestly, I mean, I would have probably gotten sick of all this, you know, all this really fancy art if I, you know, had been around for thousands and thousands of years, right? So, you know, and I think you're right. I think now it's just like, we kind of had an, you know, I think the 20s is when those, like, the kind of modern art kind of started. And I think the urinal thing was in the 20s, right? That was kind of like my mark in my head of when kind of this got going. Yeah. And then, so I think only in the past, 80 to 100 years. And I think now we had millennia of all this really fancy art, really high level. And we did modern art as kind of a reaction to that. And I think now it's, we're kind of switching into something else. I don't keep track with the painting stuff, but I really like James Turrell is one of my favorite artists of all time. He's alive today, and he experiments with light a lot. I just really love James Turrell as an artist, experimenting with light, and I feel like architecture is like the next big art experience that people.
And your octopus suit, that's art
in a way, I guess, in a way.
Oh, 100%. 100%, that's art.
Oh well,
that's, I guess, art. That's a sculpture. That thing is, I mean, that thing is pure art. 100%. 100%. It's technical and stuff, but it's a concept. It's fully realized.
It's designed to look like Dr. Octopus, right? It's artistic costume in a way.
I hope to see like a BattleBot style match between you in the octopus suit and Jeff Bezos in his mech. And
I could like climb on top of his mech and like rip it out. I think
exactly. You're smaller, but you're much more agile. Like it'll take him more time to move his arms around. Yeah, that would be a fun battle. People could bet on that.
There we go. I should challenge that to. Should make a tweet about that. Just, I'll donate $1 million to a charity if you'll fight me. Robotics, you versus me, baby.
I love it.
So I want to wrap up soon. Thank you so much for your time and talking with all these things. Because you're right there. I see you as you're going to be a big, big prominent figure in America. Well, that's what I see. You're only 20 years old. You're just getting started. And so I'm very excited to be here talking with you at this chapter. And I hope we can look back and have more chapters in the future and
I agree.
See all the growth that's happened. Are there podcasts you're listening to or things that...
Just yours.
Just thank you. Yes. Excellent. I love it. Let's end on that. Perfect. So yes. Thanks guys for watching. Please subscribe to our channel and retweet this and let us know your thoughts. Eric, thank you so much for your time and for talking with us. And
thank you.